This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're pleased to bring you what we think is a profound analysis of the Trump phenomenon.
We believe it's neo-fascism. We use the word quite purposely because if you don't know what it is, you can't fight it.
After President Barack Obama eased travel restrictions to Cuba in 2015, now the Trump administration seems to be reversing course.
In the name of human rights, Trump is now telling us that we can't go to Cuba unless we go in a group and that group is monitored and we have to report back on what we did and who we talked to.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Is Donald Trump a neo-fascist? Thoughtful analysts on the left, like Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, and Judith Butler, think he is. But mainstream liberal commentators refuse to associate the Trump phenomena with fascism. They call him a right-wing populist. What is neo-fascism? Right-wing populism. Does it really matter what Trump is called? The great German playwright and political thinker who lived in Germany during Hitler's reign, Bertolt Brecht, asked in 1935, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" We speak today with John Bellamy Foster, editor of the venerable magazine Monthly Review. He wrote the lead article in the current June 2017 issue titled, "Why It's Not Populism." John Bellamy Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. He writes about the political economy of capitalism and ecological crisis. John Bellamy Foster, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
You think that we should characterize Donald Trump and his regime as neo-fascist. Why is it important to distinguish between calling Trumpism right-wing populist, as is commonly done, and neo-fascist, as you believe?
Well, it's a difficult issue because the term fascist is sometimes used just as a term of abuse, but words matter. And our conceptions matter. And to say Trump is a right-wing populist doesn't really tell us very much. Populist, in the way they're using it now, just means somebody, whether on the right or the left, who's critical of the liberal democratic center that's dominated U.S. politics and that has a mass following. So they refer to people such as Hitler or Chavez, Bernie Sanders, Marine Le Pen, all sorts of people all over the political spectrum as populist, simply because they are opposed to the center that has dominated U.S. and world politics. So you really have to talk about what something is. In order to understand it, you have to get down to the roots of the phenomenon. And in Europe, it's well known that there has been a transnational neo-fascist movement, and it has a very clear political, social basis, and it's part of the whole long genus of fascist movements. To understand this allows us to understand what is happening today, to put Trump and his movement in context and to be able to struggle against it.
John, at the outset of your monthly review article, "This Is Not Populism," you quote Adolf Hitler, who said, quote, "I am concerned with power politics. That is to say, I make use of all means that seem to me to be of service without the slightest concern for the proprieties or for codes of honor." We presume you had Donald Trump in mind?
Yes, of course. And I thought people would immediately get it. It sounded as if it came out of Trump's mouth and really described him in some ways.
You write about Germany, and you talk about what classes in Germany Hitler drew his support. And do you think that there's a similarity in Germany and now here in the United States with Trump and where he gets his support?
Yes, there's. I was very influenced by a Gallup study that came out that said exactly that. It came out in, I think it was in early November, not long before the election. But there's quite an understanding of this in the literature. The Hitler's support came, his electoral support in the beginning when he was running for office, was from the lower middle class, or petty bourgeoisie, as they sometimes call it, and from some privileged sectors of the working class, but particularly from what we know as the lower middle class, the semi-professionals, some lower-level white-collar workers, owners of small businesses, and people who are better off than the working class in general, but in a fairly precarious position. And then he drew support from privileged sectors of the working class, from rural voters, from religious Protestants, and so on. But the basis of fascist political power has always been rooted in the lower middle class during periods of crisis, when that part of the population is thrown into a reactionary mode. And it also involves an alliance, and this is important, it always also involves an alliance with sectors of wealth, with monopoly capital, and or today monopoly finance capital. So there's an alliance between the lower middle class operating in a very reactionary mode and the very top of the wealth hierarchy.
You write that Trump in his election campaign had a, quote, neo-fascist strategy of enlisting mass support through racist and nativist appeals to lower middle class insecurities while allying with core elements of the ruling class. Can you expand on that thought, please?
Well, that really is the traditional neo-fascist strategy, is to it plays up to the reactionary elements of this part of the population, particularly when there isn't a strong left, so that the lack of a strong left prevents them from having an analysis that might incorporate them within a more democratic project. And the problems that are experienced by people in this sector of the population are then blamed on immigrants, racial groups, a whole nationalist, ethnic, racist philosophy is promoted. And there are criticisms, of course, of crony capitalists at the top and of the elites, but this is accompanied by attacks on marginalized populations everywhere. And this is a phenomenon that we know historically, and that is the basis of creating a fascist or neo-fascist movement. They rely particularly on sub-intellectual appeals to emotion. They draw very heavily on people who are in fairly privileged, relatively privileged positions with respect to the working class, but are less educated. And all of this is part of what's made fascism work in the past in its different forms.
You write that ultimately, however, the neo-fascist project, like classical fascism before it, relies on an alliance of the lower middle class with monopoly finance capital, leading ultimately to the betrayal of the movement's mass base. Is this already happening here in America? And in whose interest do the fascists really govern?
Well, it's very complicated. If you look at, say, Trump's White House, a lot is made in the news of the fact that there are two wings that are in conflict. One is represented by Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and the other one by Steve Bannon. And Kushner basically represents the financial sector, real estate, big capital. He's more of an economic than a political figure, while Bannon represents the alt-right within the administration, Breitbart, and the neo-fascist political strategy specifically aimed at the lower middle class that was so important in bringing Trump into power. Both of these elements are necessary to the overall working of this political strategy. But Trump's allegiances and, well, of course, Kushner's are mainly to the rich, to capitalism, to monopoly finance capital. So ultimately, he will follow that course. But he has to hold on to this popular lower middle class base, which is, say, the rear guard of the capitalist system, as C. Wright Mills called it. And so he has to constantly tell them that he is fulfilling his pledges to them. In fact, Steve Bannon has been shown with a whiteboard with all of Trump's pledges, mainly to the lower middle class, and with a list of his pledges on immigration, actually checking them off. And then this is put on Breitbart and actually over through the whole media. And this is meant to say that he's fulfilling his pledges to the lower middle class. But the big play, like the tax reductions, the reduction of the corporate tax from 35% max to 15%. These things, or the 75% reduction in regulations on business that he's promised, this is really about playing to monopoly finance capital, to big capital, and that's where Trump really will take his stand. But if he wants to win another election, if he wants to move forward, he somehow has to hold on to this lower middle class, particularly political base, and the alt-right, and that whole strategy as well. So it's a difficult thing to accomplish. There are betrayals that are likely to occur in this process. You know, ultimately, if he gets reelected, which isn't beyond the realm of possibility under these circumstances, he will probably betray his lower middle class base big time, because he won't need them anymore.
John, Trump got only a majority of the vote and less votes than Clinton got by 3 million. Do you think we should take any comfort in that fact?
Well, you can take comfort in whatever you want, but the politics is about winning, and the electoral college system is the system that we have. The whole basis of the higher vote of Clinton's was a higher percentage in urban areas, but the political system is set up so that rural areas have more clout than the electoral college system. Basically sets it up so that the elections aren't based simply on the majority, and the key to Trump's electoral college victory was he managed to win in the Rust Belt states, in the Midwest, which had formerly been in industrialized states, blue collar, and he managed to win in these states. Of course, you could say that given that a lot of people refused to vote, many more refused to vote or didn't vote than in the case of Obama's last election, that it was more a question of Democratic voters walking away than Republicans winning. But whatever you want, however you want to look at it, it still remains true that he managed to pull off the electoral vote in the Rust Belt states, which were traditionally blue states and basically the core of Democratic Party power for many, many years. And this has to do with his appeal to the lower middle class and to privileged sectors of the working class that have been really hurting in neoliberal times. So there's not much comfort in just having a majority of a popular vote. You actually have to win the Electoral College in an electoral contest in the United States. More important than that, it points to the fact the Democratic Party has lost a lot of its connection to workers.
Adolf Hitler came into power in Germany legally. He always pretended to uphold the rule of law, even as he was subverting it. Why is this important, and is this happening now, here?
Well, I think it's important in a number of respects. One of the things is when we talk about fascist tendencies, and the use of the term populism or right-wing populism is often used as a cloak for fascism or neo-fascism to legitimize it and to bring it within the acceptable range of politics. And the whole problem of fascism is complicated by the fact that people think have very little knowledge of what it was or what the basis of fascist state. So they'll look at things like, well, there's still adherence to the rule of law, or there's a welfare state, and they'll say, well, this proves that Trump is not anti-democratic or is not fascist, or that some people even say, well, he's a centrist or a leftist, and it creates an enormous amount of confusion. We have to understand that when the fascist states came to power, they did so partly through the rule of law, but then they subverted the political and legal institutions, and they promoted a welfare state in Italy and Germany. So it doesn't conform to what people usually think. And in order to have clarity about these things, we have to understand that. Hitler always said that he was sticking with the Weimar Constitution, but he used provisions within the Weimar Constitution's the notorious Article 48, and which allowed the government in an emergency to basically eliminate the influence of the legislature, the parliament. He used such measures like that to take over complete power. And they called the whole process of bringing the various institutions of the state into line, they called it Gleichschaltung. It means bringing into line. And what we see under Trump is, at least initially, but his government's been very beleaguered lately by Russiagate, but we see an attempt to assault the various parts of the state and to bring them into a line with the White House. We see attacks on civil liberties, And all of these things are significant. And if there was a major emergency that arose in the United States, such as a terrorist attack, there's very little doubt that that Trump would use similar provisions that have now been established by law in the United States following the Patriot Act to drastically reduce civil liberties in the country. But it would be done under the cover of legality.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I edited a book of William Kunstler's writings and speeches 13 years ago, and I called it The Emerging Police State, and Michael Ratner wrote the introduction. And we got a lot of heat for calling it that. We said, oh, you're alarmist and so on. But I think that the infrastructure for a police state really has been set up. And I think if there is a crisis, and Naomi Klein has been talking about this recently, if there's a crisis, they can certainly bring those laws into bear and really clamp down on us. Let me ask you this, John. Bertolt Brecht asked in 1935, how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Would you say that in the last 40 years of American neoliberalism, capitalism, under both the Democrats and the Republicans, they've brought forth the Trump phenomena?
Well, yeah, certainly. Neoliberalism, which was this really, neoliberalism started as a response to the slowdown of the economy, the stagnation of the economy that emerged in the 1970s. And then it transformed itself into basically the political program of monopoly finance capital or a finance-driven and concentrated economic system. And so neoliberalism has been expropriating the assets of the population. It's been breaking unions. It's been eliminating aspects of the welfare state. It's been privatizing education, and so on. And this is part of the. This is really the main trajectory of the monopoly finance capital system at present. And the result has been to turn more and more of the population against what are called the elites, because people are hurting, because inequality is going up massively in the society. And neoliberalism has become so unpopular that in order to stabilize the system, some of those at the top believe that we have to go in a neo-fascist direction, that is, reduce any threat from democracy. And this is a traditional response of capitalism in crisis. And one of the key way to do that is to take advantage of lower middle class that is easily pushed in reactionary directions, particularly in terms when there is a weak left. So if you look at Breitbart, which is the central organ of the alt-right, and of course Bannon still manages Breitbart, he's been allowed to do that within the Trump administration. Breitbart is funded by monopoly finance capital, by some of the biggest billionaires in the United States. And it's aimed entirely, though, at the lower middle class and privileged sectors of the working class, and promoting nationalism, racial hatred, patriarchy, anti-immigrant attitudes, and so on. And this is a political strategy to create a neo-fascist political spectrum that can stabilize the system, because the system is characterized now by economic stagnation, long-term economic stagnation, prone to financial crises, and there will be another big financial crisis, and by declining U.S. Economic hegemony and rising inequality. So how do you stabilize such a system? they have basically moved, or a spectrum of the capitalist class is moving towards neo-fascism as a way of stabilizing neoliberalism or replacing it.
John, we just have a few minutes remaining. Do you think building and reforming the Democratic Party is a productive way to fight back against Trumpism?
Well, the short answer is no, but the long answer is quite a bit longer. You know, Bernie Sanders is historically one of the biggest critics of the Democratic Party and always said you really couldn't change things within the Democratic Party. But he has moved now towards trying to shift the whole nature of the Democratic Party. That's incredibly difficult to do, and I don't think it will happen. But more important than that is that if we're going to build a electoral political movement, you have to have an extra electoral movement. You have to build a political base at the bottom of society. You have to build alternatives. There have to be other organizations at the bottom of the society and mass organization, mass movements that define their own objectives. And I think it will only be rational and systematic if it's socialist, aimed at substantive equality for all people. But this has to happen, and the Democratic Party is controlled by certain political elites, and more than that, by the capitalist class. What we have to do is build a political momentum of a different kind at the base of the society, and that could conceivably change the Democratic Party into something else, or we create something else. But without the base movement, nothing will happen. We'll have Democratic Party is dedicated to neoliberalism and capitalism, and it really has to be abandoned ultimately if we're going to go forward.
John Bellamy Foster, how can people listening today follow your work?
Well, I'm editor of the monthly review, so you can find all sorts of things about me in articles on monthly review. And in this context, I have a little book coming out called Trump in the White House, which will be out in a couple of months, and that will be a low-cost, short book and something that will present these ideas more systematically.
Well, we look forward to talking to you when the book comes out. We'll help you launch it, John.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder, John Bellamy Foster. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Bridgeport man, ooh, living in a Bridgeport town.